Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with Thomas Jefferson, our third president. Thomas Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
Mr. President, it's always a delight to have these conversations with you. I thank you again for coming to visit with myself and with the American public.
Well, I do believe that an honest public discussion about affairs of importance to the nation is the best way to disseminate enlightenment.
Agreed, sir. And on that note, I've invited a very special guest to join us in our conversation today. Now, I know, Mr. President, you've always had a fascination with the native cultures of North America.
I'm always eager, of course, to meet with Indians. I met with Indians in a number of different instances in the course of my life. I met with Indians as a private citizen of Virginia. I met with Indians as the first Secretary of State in the Washington administration, but principally I met with Native peoples during my 8 years as the third President of the United States. And it was quite common in that time for Indian delegations to visit the Great Father in Washington, to visit George Washington, to visit John Adams, to visit James Madison or Monroe or myself. And before our colonial experience had ended, it was quite common for Indian delegations to cross the Great Water, to go to Britain and meet with the king.
I know, Mr. President, that you met with representatives of many of the tribes. I'm wondering, did you ever have a chance to meet someone from the Lakota Nation?
Yes, we would have used the word Sioux in my time. There were some Sioux visitors in the course of my presidency. Interestingly enough, in the Lewis and Clark expedition, which from this perspective was a recruiting mission for Indian delegations, led to three visits to the White House by Indians between 1804 and 1809 when I left office voluntarily. And there may have been some Sioux individuals with these delegations, but they were principally of other tribes. Lewis and Clark sent back an Osage delegation, and that was 1805. They sent back an Arikara delegation, also in 1805. And then when they came back in 1806, Lewis brought with him a Mandan delegation, a man named Shehekshote, or the wolf, or a coyote, came to visit me, and he came to the White House on the last days of December and New Year's Day, 1806 and 1807. So three delegations came out of the Great Plains, you might say, out of the Louisiana Purchase. And there were, I believe, some Sioux individuals included. But there was not a formal Sioux delegation because, as you know, even though I was aware that the Sioux were the most powerful tribe of the upper Missouri, and I urged Mr. Lewis to really bend over backwards to conciliate the Sioux, the Lakota, as you're calling them, he came back and reported that they had been hostile to our national purposes and that he believed that it would take military chastisement to bring them into a serious negotiation with the United States.
Well, you must have interest in their culture, sir. And I'm sure you would have questions for the Lakota people were you able to present them.
Well, of course. I mean, there are really two ways to talk about that. On the one hand, as the President of the United States, I have to represent the interests of my nation. I met with Indian delegations. I told them about the power and the purposes of the United States, about our Constitution, about our commitment to natural rights, about our intention to explore the American West and eventually settle it. These are policy questions. This is what a president does. He represents the official will of the people that he presides over. But I'm also a scientist and I suppose even an anthropologist. And in that sense, I'm just purely and deeply fascinated by Indian cultures. And one of the joys for me was meeting Indians and seeing their dress and seeing their dance and seeing their music and hearing their language and, if possible, taking down their language. I like to take vocabularies of Indian languages.
Well, perhaps we'll be able to converse further about culture and language. Allow me to present today's special guest, a member of the Lakota Nation.
Nice to meet you, Mr. President.
And good to see you, citizen. May I ask your name?
I have two names. I have a name that, you know, I use in everyday English, which is Kevin Locke. And then also I've got a ceremonial name, which is Tokahe Ainaji. Tokahe Ainaji, you could translate this as the first to arise or the first to stand up.
And how would you like me to call you, sir?
You could call me Kevin Locke or Kevin.
But first to stand up, that would be that would please me more because I like this. One of the things I most admire about Indian cultures is the poetic nature of your names.
Oh yes, there's so many. I've got a grandmother. Her name was Miniata Ojajawi, and it means that, like, if you ever see the sun or moon rising, and then it casts over the water, and it'll cast a beam of light. And that's what that name refers to, this beam of light over the water.
Say the name again.
Miniata Ojajawi.
Now, from the I got more than 40 vocabularies of Indian languages in the course of my life, and some of them were tragically lost when I retired from the presidency. But I believe that mini is a Suyan word for water, is it not?
Yes, it's mini is water. That's right.
And so you have mini Wakon and mini Minnesota.
Minnesota. Also, the state of Nebraska is derived from that Minibadaska. The Daska means the flat. So we're referring to the Platte River, which at its mouth is very broad.
So you're saying that the modern word Nebraska is a truncation of a longer word that had many in it.
Yes, Minibadaska.
Interesting. So, but Mr. Lewis brought back these vocabularies, and the Mandan were Suyan, and the Hidatsa were Suyan. There were many Suyan tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So the language is wider than the tribe itself.
Yes, but in Hidatsa, if you say water, they say midi, like coffee. They say midi shibisha. Shibisha is black, but midi is the water part.
So black water.
Yeah, so you can see that the language changes. You know, the root word, you could identify the root word. For instance, in Crow language, which is also a Siouan language.
Crow is a Hidatsa cousin, is it
close,
not?
Yeah, close cognate to the Hidatsa. And in Crow, the word for coffee, they say bili ishpida. So they change it to bili. See, bili. But you can see where it would have just transformed or metamorphosized the root word.
Bili, Crow, Bidi, Hidatsa, and then Mini.
We say Mini.
Lakota. Yeah.
Yes. And the Omaha also, which are closely related, they simply say Ni. Ni is water.
Ni.
Ni. So they've truncated the word even further, or the root word even further.
You see, Mr. Swenson, this is why I wanted to collect these vocabularies, because if you can put them in a grid, if you can have the Crow word for water and the Mandan word for water and the Hidatsa word for water and the Omaha word for water or the Missouri word for water, and you put them all in a chart, you can see which ones are related, and that will tell you two things. It will tell you how tribes have dispersed across North America. I mean, there may be tribes that are thousands of miles apart which share a common linguistic base and therefore probably a common origin. And if you watch the way these words evolve across cultures, you can probably see which cultures were related to which and when they separated. You can actually trace the history of Suyan peoples by examining the cognate words for water and fire and child and birth and God and so on.
This is very interesting, and one would note that you could learn a lot from these charts, but what you may miss from these charts is the actual beauty of the language. Now, I know Kevin well enough to know how beautifully he speaks Lakota, and when there are meetings between two great men such as yourselves, it's protocol that it would start with perhaps a prayer. I'm wondering if you would favor us with a prayer in your language, Kevin.
Yes, I could. I'd be glad to offer a short prayer. Ahoa kantanka, tunkashila, le ape kiha, Okshank shahiotak api naha, Ptelela uniksi api naha, Tunkashila, ni ishtawa ka, hiche kayala, awa uyechigala kapie naha, ni nure wa ka u ana uyechihuptapie. Hona ishe tunkashila wa kantunka echalachi, wola kota, we chosani na wokie, na woa chantke, wok sape. Ihawa steste yak ubiktana dagni shicha akipaktishni ho ushunkilapie onkiapie ho heche dolo ha mitakewasi. Which is, I'm asking in my prayer, we say, Grandfather, Great Spirit, on this day we are gathered and we're turning our hearts and our minds to you and ask that with your watchful eye that you could grant us protection, and with your hearkening ear that you may incline yourselves to our voice and to our ways here, and ask that you could grant to the people peace and wisdom and compassion, and that you may ever bless us and have compassion upon us and grant us your mercy.
Thank you, sir.
Well, very, very beautiful, and I wish that I could take that down. You know, one of the problems is that English has a Roman alphabet, and we have a set of sounds that come from the long evolution of the English tongue. When Lewis and Clark came to your people, they used their Roman alphabet to try to take down words just like those, and it's extremely difficult to transcribe non-English sounds into an English-based Roman alphabet, and for example, why there's so much dispute about whether it's Sheheko or Shehekshot or whether it's Sacagawea or Sacagawea or Sacagawea. These were honest mistakes that Lewis and Clark made. They were listening to try to hear these sounds, and I've been scribbling here, if I could take down your prayer, I would be in a position now to construct something like a grammar of Lakota, or to take each word and put it into this dictionary form alphabetically and ask you. I heard, for example, woksape, mm-hmm. just as an example. What does that word mean?
Wisdom.
Wisdom. So there woksape would be under W. I would say W-O-K-S-A-P-E. I don't know.
Precisely, yes.
And that would be then wisdom. And wakan, is that your word for the Great Spirit?
Wakan means sacred or holy.
Sacred?
Yes.
So I would put that under W so that you would, if we went over this prayer 100 times today, I might be able to get it and then create a dictionary. And then others, I could compare that to Crow later this evening, and that would give me a sense of, you know, when the Sioux and the Crow knew each other and under what circumstances.
Gentlemen, we need to take a short pause, but we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, our third president. Thomas Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and joining Mr. Jefferson and I this week is the renowned Lakota flutist, dancer, and storyteller Kevin Locke. When we left, gentlemen, we were discussing languages, and in particular the Lakota language. And Mr. Jefferson, I noted that you were making your lists again, but I do believe it's the beauty of the language that one must notice.
Well, I do acknowledge that languages can be beautiful. I mean, Provençal is a beautiful version of French, and you know, the poetry is, in a sense, creating beautiful rhythm out of English or Italian or whatever base language we use. But you must keep in mind that I am a creature of the Enlightenment. I regard these as scientific questions, so I want to create a dictionary. As you know, I don't pray to any god. I don't believe in a great spirit. I believe that humans are on Earth and we're all alone, and we have to build utopia and justice on Earth, and that prayer may be efficacious, but I don't believe if I attempted to pray to the Episcopalian God that there's anyone listening.
Did Lewis and Clark bring back information about the religious practices of native tribes, Mr. President?
Well, there's a fascinating book on this subject in your time by a professor by the name of James Rhonda called Lewis and Clark Among the Indians. And one of his arguments is, and it's quite natural if you think about it, is that they're going to be much better about things they can see than things that they would have to imagine or understand. So Lewis could see how a woman's dress looked. Lewis could see what a pipe looked like or and how it was assembled and of what stone, what clay it had been made. They could see the difference between a Yankton teepee and a Mandan earth lodge. They could see how a buffalo was dressed by the Hidatsa people. They could examine bows and arrows and knives and so on. But when it comes to that which is beyond the material, metaphysics, how a people thinks, what their great spirit means to them, the poetry of their lifestyle, or their philosophy of origins, these are much, much more difficult to get at. And keep in mind, Lewis and Clark were moving quickly. They weren't an anthropological study group that could spend 5 years with the Lakota. They were passing through in a few days and noting down everything they could. But when it comes to the metaphysics, all historians give Lewis and Clark lower marks in that area. And if perhaps Mr. Locke can clear this up for us, but if metaphysics is more important to Indians than it is to white people of the Enlightenment, you know, if spirituality is central to Indian life in a way that it wasn't, say, to George Washington's life, then Lewis and Clark are going to miss a good deal of the cultures they're seeing if they're missing something that's primary in those cultures but secondary or tertiary in ours.
Well, what about that, Mr. Locke? What could you share with President Jefferson about the religion of the Lakota during that time?
I would think that at that particular time, the people's, the entirety of people's life was imbued with the spirituality or the metaphysical aspect. And the basis of this, especially for the Lakota, is the teachings of a woman. This woman, appearance of this woman who was thought to be commissioned by Wakantanka. We say Tunkashila. Wakantanka, which means the grandfather, great spirit. And so this woman or maiden was commissioned to appear on this earth and the people, granted, were in a time of great suffering, not just physical suffering, but the effects of that in terms of their internal life, which resulted in disputes and quarrels and general misery within their hearts and minds. And so probably at the darkest hour in the history of the people, the people believed that the grandfather above, the great spirit, commissioned this being to appear and to bring them a token of his love, a token of his mercy, according to their capacity. And so during the time of Mr. Jefferson, this would have been the only form of worship that the people had, and it would have been based on this brief appearance, some say only a four-day period of time in which this woman appeared and taught them. Of course, now you realize that the people at that time didn't have a written way of communication. So everything was done through symbology. And so she brought these teachings and she left them the original pipe, the sacred pipe, which is symbolic of these teachings. So you could say in a way that the pipe is like symbolic of the Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence, maybe even the Bible. It has this much sanctity so that in the course of their journey, Lewis and Clark undoubtedly would have, this may have been one of the first formalities that they would have experienced, which was the people would have brought their pipe out and prayed in order to create amity and goodwill and to invoke the ear of the one above, the creator. And this all would have been this all would have been inspired through the message of this woman, who also, in the course of her, now she was only made a brief appearance of some 4 days, they say, but she had promised that different laws and different teachings would be revealed. And so you could say that she inaugurated or initiated a dispensation, a period of time in which her spiritual laws would be predominant. And within those laws, there were spiritual laws, which are immutable. It's it's I think this would be there would be congruent throughout the world. I think every spiritual tradition has these basic spiritual laws. And within her dispensation, she also inaugurated social laws. Social laws. And of course, that's merely attuned to the exigencies, the conditions of the people at that time. And her dispensation also includes prophecies about what the people could expect in the times beyond her dispensation.
And those teachings and that knowledge are still vibrant within the Lakota people today, are they not?
Yes, and I think today experiencing somewhat of a revival, mm-hmm. because of the different social conditions, social decay that has occurred in recent generations. And I think people have found that reconnecting with these traditions, especially the universal aspects, is very therapeutic, very cathartic, very healing.
Well, I find this, of course, fascinating, Mr. Locke. For one thing, you see some sort of universal motifs here in the Christian tradition, and I don't actually regard myself as a Christian, but I certainly know something about it. God sent his emissary to earth, Jesus, and Jesus was here for 30-some years, but his ministry was really a very short ministry of a couple of years. And this woman, as you say, for four days, but she too was God's emissary on earth. But she seems to combine part of what Jesus was and part of what Moses was. She's the one who brought the law to your people. Is that not so?
There were certain laws, of course, that were in effect before, but I think what has occurred, I know now throughout the world, is that divine inspiration, which is very powerful and very binding and very compelling initially, over time it begins to fade slowly. And so there comes a time when these laws need to be reestablished or revivified or made new. And so I believe that the people did have laws that predated her appearance, but that the people, through their disobedience, perhaps, to those laws, had fallen into a state of despondency, which necessitated a renewal, which is what she brought.
May I ask you a question about this? You know, when Jesus came to minister onto humankind in ancient Palestine, he was not treated very well. How was she treated when she made her appearance?
Now, that is a very profound question, because that was always a question. I know that people who first heard of Christianity is the incredulity, their disbelief that a being of such high station could have been so mistreated, because this would have been unthinkable of the people who received this being, her name is Ptehinchalaskawi, which means the white buffalo calf woman.
Ptehinchalaskawi?
Ptehinchala.
Ptehinchala.
Ptehinchala means a buffalo calf. It's a specific word.
The white buffalo calf woman.
Yeah, and then ska means white, and then at the end, we means the woman.
We, as in Sacagawea.
Yes, yeah. See, now that is from the Hiradza. They say Sacagawea. Sacagawea.
But we as woman.
Yeah, it's the same for us, but we just tend to cut the end off. So
I don't want to get in the way of your story, but ska is white.
White.
We are is woman.
Exactly.
And then what is the buffalo in that?
It's a buffalo calf. It's Ptehinchala.
Ptehinchala.
You said it good.
What's an adult buffalo?
Well, if it's a male, they'll say Tatanka.
Tatanka?
Yes, Tatanka.
Wakan Tatanka?
No, just Wakantanka.
Okay.
Well, you could say Tatanka Wakan, see? But which we use.
Sacred buffalo.
Yes, but the word for the Great Spirit is Wakantanka.
But a buffalo calf, is a buffalo calf female different from a buffalo calf male?
Same word.
Same word. And say it one more time.
Ptehinchala.
Ptehinchala. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Wonderful. Yes. Wonderful.
So carry on. So this woman comes, and you said that your people couldn't even contemplate mistreating her.
No. In fact, the people that received, there was a headsman, you could say. His name was Tatanka Woslal Naji, which means a buffalo that stands upright, like on its back legs, it stands upright. And that was his name, and he received this revelation, or received this great message, on behalf of all the people at that time and on behalf of all the future generations. And so this is the high water mark, you could say, of Lakota culture. This short few days, and so basically all of the current spiritual practices will invoke elements of her appearance, and in that they have efficacy.
Oh, this pipe that was given to the people, we know of its location today.
Yes, it's housed in a very beautiful structure, which is created in recent times, and it's in a location on the Cheyenne River Reservation, in a just outside of a small community called Greengrass.
Wait, you're saying that the actual pipe that this white buffalo calf woman brought to Lakota humankind continues to exist in the 21st century?
Yes, and Tatanka Wosla Naji, the original recipient, was the first keeper, and the current keeper is the 19th. So it passed down 19 times now up to today.
How did this survive the cataclysm of the 19th century?
Well, it's simply because the people had so much reverence for it that it was, and they realized, I think they well realized, how imperiled it was in the face of maybe zealous Christians, that it was kept well hidden. It was a well-guarded secret.
I'm against missionaries, but is this a Catlinite pipe? Or are you not allowed to say?
I actually don't know. I think the current keeper may be one of the few that's ever seen it. And it may be described, but I can't recall whether it is made of Catlinite. It could well be.
I think it's also a testament to the strength of the Lakota people, their culture, that this has been preserved for so long. I did a poor job in introducing Mr. Locke to you, Mr. President, and not acknowledging just where he's from, but he comes from a village, a small town called Wakpala, which is located on the Standing Rock Reservation, very near the route that Lewis and Clark took up the river.
Yes. Well, let me just ask you another question, because I don't really know much about this white buffalo calf woman. Lewis and Clark didn't report anything about that, but they did say that when they got to the what they called the Teton Sioux, or the the Brule, and had their trouble, that it was 4 days of intense diplomacy, and at one point the Sioux were very nice to Lewis and Clark, and they invited them to come for a feast. And what they said, what the journal keeper said, was that when the captains came to get off the boat, the Indians wouldn't let them walk. They put them on buffalo robes and carried them as honorary guests into the village, and only then placed them down. And there was I believe there was dog flesh by way of a sacrifice, and there was an elaborate pipe ceremony. And does that sound like your people?
Yes. Yeah, that sounds like a very, very good initial treatment. Very honorable to have them carried into the village. And of course, the dog meat, now that's the highest honor that you can receive.
Why is that?
Well, you know, that you can well imagine that, contrary to, you know, the current station of the dog, you see, the people were really dependent on their dogs. And especially before the horse came, that was their means of transport.
On these travois or something?
Yes, they would construct small carriers or travois that were harnessed to the dogs. And so the dogs were imperative. There was just critical usage for the survival of the people. And the dogs, of course, also provided companionship. They were indispensable for hunting. And so it was really a total symbiotic relationship. So what the dog meat represents is the most dear thing to the people. So for a person to give up something so precious was thought of as a mark of honor. Also, of course, there are certain feasts, ceremonial feasts, that use the dog meat. So it's not common at all. It's very rare, very special.
Well, here's how I understand it, and you tell me if I'm wrong. When Lewis and Clark first arrived, the Teton Sioux said, look, it's our river. You can't just come through here without paying a tribute. We control access here, and we don't want you trading. That looks like that's what you're going to do, trading up above us. So you have to go through us, and we want you to either turn back or to give us a very substantial amount of your what's in those boats. But there's no way we're just going to stand back and let you pass through. And Lewis and Clark made it very clear that they were not going to be intimidated. And then there was this two-day period of feasting and dancing, and it was quite enjoyable for Lewis and Clark, even though they were on edge. But then finally on the last day when they wanted to go, this man named the Partisan, I don't know what his Lakota name would have been, but he said, look, you're not going forward. And there was a standoff, and there was nearly bloodshed. And then a more conciliatory leader by the name of Black Buffalo said, well, no, we're going to let you go, but you have to give us something. And eventually Lewis and Clark gave him a carrot of tobacco as a token of this thing. Does that seem like that might have happened? And does that ring true to you?
Well, I can see that the tobacco would have been very precious also. And so, if somebody offers you tobacco, then it would be a supreme breach of etiquette to refuse what they're requesting. So I can well see that once the tobacco was offered, and especially in a ceremonial sense, then it would be beneath the dignity of the people to refuse.
Yeah, that's true to this day, isn't
it,
Kevin?
Very true today. Yes.
Yeah. It's still. Why is that?
It's quite complex, but as you know, the tobacco is a very powerful substance. Today we know that there are, you know, millions of people that are, but in the times of Thomas Jefferson, there would have been extensive use of tobacco, especially in Virginia and the East Coast and all throughout that area, and maybe a short way of explaining it is that there's I'll tell a brief story if I may.
Kevin, we would love to hear that story, but we need to take a short pause now. Mr. President, would you be willing to stay for one more segment and discuss these matters with us today?
I would. I have to say, I'm utterly fascinated by what I'm hearing here, and it does give me some new insights on the troubles that Lewis and Clark had between September 24th and 28th of 1804 on the Upper Missouri.
Excellent. We'll take a short pause, Mr. President, Mr. Locke, and we'll rejoin this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with Thomas Jefferson, our third president. Joining me now are President Thomas Jefferson and Kevin Locke. And Kevin, you were about to share a story with us regarding the importance of tobacco to the Lakota people.
Yes. According to several narratives that I'll try and make a composite of, all the beautiful things in this world are gifts or tokens from the heavenly worlds above. And so then all these gifts were put down in this creation, but there were certain gifts that were withheld. And so now one of the high-flying animals, I believe it was the eagle, went up so high and looked over and saw some of the gifts that were being withheld from this creation and asked the Creator why. And so the Creator said that one gift in particular, all of the animals need to have a consensus regarding who should receive this gift, because this gift was so holy and so sacred and so powerful, because its use would necessitate that it be used on behalf of all of creation for the good of all. And so the eagle was commissioned to go back down into this world and assemble all the creatures and for them to decide amongst themselves who would receive this. So all the animals, they got together and they all put forth their own ascendancy or their own, you know, special qualities that would merit their receipt of this gift. And finally, after most of them had spoken, one little animal spoke up and said, "Yes, we are all powerful, but there is one amongst us who is nearly blind, who is almost deaf by comparison to the rest of us, who has almost worthless teeth, can't really hear worth a darn, can't run very fast, can't dig, can't swim, can't fly, is just naked and can't survive heat or cold or anything. There's one amongst us who lacks all of these qualities." And as this little animal was talking about, describing this creature, then all the other animals, they began to come into a form of consensus and agreement as they realized that there was one that was the most pitiful, the least endowed of all the creatures. And so then as they reached this consensus, the creator, the grandfather from above, looked down and spoke and said, "Well done, my grandchildren. You indeed have arrived at a conclusion which is congruent with my own thought, my own mind. And as you have decided, thus it shall be. And from henceforth, these two-legged ones," in other words, human beings, "would receive this gift. And when they use this gift, they will remember their relationship with me, with the heavens above," in other words, "and also the relationship with all of creation. And when this gift is used properly, then I will know that this covenant is being upheld." And so what that was, the gift was, in other words, was the gift of tobacco. So in Virginia and other places in the East, if you examine carefully those accounts or journals which are more detailed, you will see that when the native people gathered and consulted with, you know, their European guests, one of the first things, or perhaps the very first thing that was done, either the tobacco was used or shared in the form of a pipe ceremony being passed around, or they would separate the coals from the main fire and offer a prayer, both to begin and perhaps also to conclude, to consecrate the consultation. And they would take this tobacco and they would put it on the coals, and then smoke would ascend, representing their entreaty to the heavens above. And so this is something that occurred pretty much throughout Eastern North America, all the way through this region, on almost probably past the Rocky Mountains, the sacred use of tobacco. And one of the interesting things was that attached to this was that it was foretold that as long as these things are remembered, the tobacco would be a blessing. But it was foretold that there would become a time when these covenants would be forgotten. And this great gift, which could be used, you know, as a way of making us mindful of this relationship, if these things are forgotten, this great gift could turn into something very deadly and very harmful. And that this would be a sign that these covenants must needs be renewed.
Well, in my culture, tobacco was a cash crop, but even in my time, we regarded it as a noxious crop. I said that tobacco produces infinite wretchedness in the land and in the people, and I was sorry that I couldn't get out from under my addiction to growing it as a cash crop. So the two traditions are similar and different. And we grew it as a commercial thing and sold it for non-sacred purposes, essentially. And your tradition is saying that it has to be used in a certain way, or it can become noxious.
Yeah, because as you well noted, it's very habit forming, very addictive, and so people, if they misuse it, it can destroy one's health.
Interesting. You know, one of the things I've been thinking about as you told that fascinating story is that Lewis and Clark suffered from a problem. They were discoverers. And it's not that the people they were discovering didn't already know who they were, but for white civilization, it was the first contact in many cases. And so Lewis and Clark weren't in a position to know what they needed to do with the Sioux, what they needed to do with the Cheyenne, what they needed to do with the Shoshone or the Clatsop or the Nez Perce, because there was no, they couldn't hire somebody who could say, well, when you get to the Tetons, tobacco's sacred there, and a gift of tobacco will open some doors. They had to sort of blunder their way through as discoverers because they didn't, there were no guides. There were no manuals to say, you know, a dog is a sacred thing, so if you refuse to eat it, you're committing a hospitality violation.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Jefferson, you know, I reading through your papers and preparing for this show, your opinions and writings on Native peoples varied quite a lot. I'm surprised, actually, at some of the inconsistencies I've found.
How so?
Well, in the Declaration of Independence, you referred to Native peoples as savages.
Well, no, they were being whipped up as merciless savages by the British to attack American settlers. You know, all people can be savage. Napoleon is a savage. Attila was a savage. Andrew Jackson was a savage in some moods. The term savage actually comes from the French sauvage, which means creatures of the woods, which I think is a rather poetic term, but it had already become the kind of negative term in my time that you point to. But clearly, when the British stirred up Iroquois and the Huron and others on our western flank then, this is way before the Sioux, to attack white villages and massacre people, I was blaming the British, not the Indians on this occasion.
It was a way to call them enemies, but you used the word savages.
Merciless savages.
There was a marquee that you wrote to at one point that you said you believed them to be complete equals to white people.
Well, absolutely. Indians.
So there is my
Well, I don't think there's any. No, I think all human nature is constant. I'll be interested to hear from Mr. Locke on this. Well, let me just quickly tell you how I saw it. Human nature is a constant. The Germans, the Lakota, the Nez Perce, the Italians. So human nature is constant all over the world. People are jealous. People are worried about death. People have to decide how they mate and under what circumstances. There's anger, there's hope, there's love, there's optimism, there's despair. These things are constant across all cultures. But there are different variations of the way cultures handle these sorts of things. And I would say that the Lakota, from what I knew, were a more warlike people than the Mandan, who were disposed to be more peaceful. And you could make a lot of cultural discriminations along these lines. But it seems to me that if you're asking what is an Indian, and that's a question we had to ask because there's no biblical Indian, there's no Indian in St. Thomas Aquinas. Indians were new to Western civilization beginning with Columbus. So we had to decide what is an Indian. Is it inferior? Is it fully human? Is it more than human? Are their cultures subordinate to ours? Are they primitives? Are they superior to us? I wrestled with that question, as all people do. I'm sure when the Lakota first met with the Comanche, they had to ask the same questions. But my conclusion is that Indians are inherently every bit equal to whites. The capacities of the two cultures are identical. And in some respects, I regard Indians as superior because of, I think Mr. Locke was saying it, in a rudimentary, I won't call it primitive, but in a rudimentary culture with rudimentary technologies, there's a premium on the physical capacities, running, jumping, shooting a bow and arrow, defense, prowess, physical prowess, physical capacities. In Western civilization, as represented in, say, by Voltaire or Louis XVI, was debased. We were no longer robust in that way. And so I regarded Indians as these marvelous physical specimens, almost like creatures out of the Homeric age that could teach us what humans were like when they were closer to nature again. And we needed to learn from Indians to reconnect with nature. That's what they do so well. You know, we can give them the alphabet and we can give them flint and we can give them metal guns, but it's not clear that we're giving them something that really improves them. It'll certainly make their lives more convenient, but it will also uproot them in certain respects from that nobility that they have.
Your thoughts, Mr. Locke?
Oh, it's just fascinating to hear this point of view, and this is the ideal of the currently, even today, of the ideal is to, in life, is to be what they call ikchewichasha. Ikchewichasha means, you could say, like maybe a natural or maybe a grassroots or a common person. somebody who doesn't put themselves above anybody or below anybody, but strives to quietly embody these virtues or ideals. And among them, of course, is wobbly hecha, which is it's to be courageous, but it's also to have fortitude, inner fortitude, to have kind of a quiet dignity. And also, it also refers to the ability to withstand physical hardship and to be able to succeed in these really strenuous lifestyle. You can imagine out here in what's now North Dakota, where, as you well know, goes down to 30, 40 below zero, and just trying to eke out an existence, even to survive in a skin lodge. And so that requires a lot of physicality, a lot of fortitude.
A ki'io cha-cha, what was
that? Ikche. Ikche it's not really exactly analogous with an English word, but it just refers to being close to the earth, you know, natural or down to earth, or just, I wouldn't say common, but to be one with the people.
To be rooted or,
yes.
You know, when we use the term noble savage, which sometimes is not seen as a polite term in your era, but we meant the nobility of a forest people.
Yes. So Ikcheuchasha, it doesn't mean to strive to gain ascendancy or to strive to gain an advantage over anybody, but to be humble also, to be humble.
Well, Kevin, in the few moments that we have left, you've listened to President Jefferson, and President Jefferson, either knowingly or unknowingly, has shown you that there were a lot of judgments made by this culture that invaded Middle America several centuries ago.
I object to that, by the way, but go ahead.
And I wonder if your culture had judgments on his culture. And anything you'd like to share?
Well, I think the basic word, from my understanding, is just incredulity. I think I'm saying that right, which is just an amazement of the people that could create such astounding inventions, and yet fail to solve basic things such as providing for the needs of their lowest. And see, this is a mark of an Ikcheuchash, is you're always first to take care of the orphans, the poor. I know I was reading these accounts of Sitting Bull, who commented that when he went to New York City, he just couldn't believe the poverty that existed there. And he spent a lot of his time just passing out whatever he could to these poor people that were just living on the streets. He couldn't believe that they were street people. And so I think that this is... But basically, the people did, I know, accord respect. The word for the president in our Lakota language is they do call the president Tunkashila or Tunkashilayapi, which means he whom they have for a grandfather. So it is a title of respect, a title of veneration, and even the agents who are stationed along the Missouri River, they call them Ateapi. They who they have for a father. So the title is not derogatory at all, but it's quite honorific, the titles that are used. And even the word for the there are words for different the word for a person of European background, the general word is Washichu, which is not a bad word, really. It's not bad. Yeah, a lot of people say it's derived from Iwashichu, which means to be overly loquacious, a little bit too talkative or too forward.
I thought vocally. That meant he who takes the best or he who takes the.
Well,
the
that's fat. Another yeah. word. That's some people say that too. Washichu is a contraction of two words. Washin ichu. Washin is like when you're making your soup and then you get that. It's like the creme de la creme. You know the very finest part of the cream. Well, when you're making soup, then you boil it over a couple of times and you can take that top part off.
Right.
And that's kind of a delicacy. And so that some people say it comes from that. I think they're probably all right. It's just an observation of the tendency to kind of be a little bit overly aggressive.
But the Lakota at that time must have known that the real reason these people were coming up river was land.
Yes, I'm sure they were wise to that.
I object to that also, of course.
On what grounds, sir? On what grounds?
Because
your own writings detail how this was going to be done.
I instructed Meriwether Lewis to say to all the Indians that he met, we do not wish to buy a single acre of your land. You may stay on your land in perpetuity, that we are here to explore, we're here to measure, we're here to examine.
But, sir, you wrote Henry Harrison in 1803 and detailed secretly a plan to take this land, did you not?
Well, not this land. That was the Ohio Valley. And what I said to him, and I'm perfectly candid about this, is that if white people are going to move into these zones that have previously been controlled by Indians, that if we want these lands better than fight war, we should encourage the chiefs to borrow lavishly at the trading post. To
become
buy whatever,
indebted,
get
so
a little
they would
in debt,
have to sell their
and
land.
And then when
yes.
they get over their heads in debt, maybe they sell Ohio. I regard that as a legitimate approach to this.
Well, there is so much to discuss. And Mr. Locke, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. It's just been, speaking for myself, a real pleasure to see you. I'm honored that you would join us today. And perhaps I could make the suggestion that if your schedule allows, you could join us again next week and we could clear up some of these leftover issues. Would you be willing to come back, sir?
Oh, that would be my pleasure.
Well, let's look forward to that then, shall we, Mr. President?
I would very much enjoy learning more from this gentleman. Thank you.
With that, we'll say goodbye to our listeners. And again, I thank you both. Thank you for listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. Thomas Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. Clay Jenkinson is a Dickinson State University Roosevelt Scholar in Residence, with support from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. The title of this week's show is Jefferson and the Lakota. If you'd like to make a $12 donation and receive a copy of this program, please call 1-888-828-2853. The Jefferson Hour is also available on iTunes and at our website at www.jeffersonhour.org. And be sure to leave a question for Mr. Jefferson. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you by the New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios by David Swenson. Audio engineer, Lisa Dehonik. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.